This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think solar is one of these sort of rare issues that it isn't going to hew to our normally divisive American politics, and there's no real reason for it to, because it is a matter of, you know, people can become energy entrepreneurs by putting some panels on the roof and selling to their neighbors. You know, it's sort of as American as apple pie once you get past the powerful vested interests who are in, you know, want to keep America hooked on fossil fuels.
Think about the sunniest states in the U.S. Florida, the place that calls itself the Sunshine State, is sure to come to mind. Indeed, the solar industry considers Florida to be the state with the third greatest rooftop solar potential in the country. So the place must be almost totally off the grid at this point, right? Well, no. Florida boasts only 9,000 homes with solar rooftops, while New York, a state with a similar size population and a much less hospitable weather profile, has 25,000. So what's going on with Florida? Do people there just really like to pay more for their electricity? Or is it something else? My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Rolling Stone reporter Tim Dickinson, who's just completed an excellent piece of investigative journalism on Florida and the role the Koch brothers play in thwarting the use of the world's most renewable and abundant power source. With the hot pants on, she do the funky Broadway all night long. The girl on there with the hot pants on, filthy Mac Dixon. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Tim Dickinson. He's a Rolling Stone reporter, and his latest piece is The Koch Brothers' Dirty War on Solar Power. Tim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, glad to be with you.
Even though the title of this is The Koch Brothers' Dirty War on Solar Power, a lot of the focus of your excellent piece is on Florida and its anti-solar policies. So how does Florida rank 16th in solar power production when it is the Sunshine State?
It's this amazing paradox, right? I mean, and it's actually much worse than it sounds. You know, California is the runaway solar giant at like 10 gigawatts, and followed by Arizona at about 2 gigawatts, and then it really trails off after that, and Florida drags in, I think right now after Massachusetts, certainly New Jersey, and I think even Connecticut has snuck in front of it. So just to give you a sense of it's an amazing laggard despite having the third best rooftop solar potential in the country and the best solarity east of the Mississippi, obviously just given its southern latitude. So the reason that Florida is not a solar producer has everything to do with the political sway of the utilities, the monopoly utilities in Tallahassee, and sort of the utilities' grip on the political process down there. The sort of key policies that have allowed solar to explode elsewhere are either absent or actually illegal in Florida. So there is no, unlike even in conservative places like Texas, there's no renewable energy portfolio standard. So there's no a requirement that Florida generate any portion of its electrical generation from renewable sources. So that's really an outlier. And then it turns out that it's actually illegal for third parties to operate in the state as sellers of electricity. So what that does is it says that companies like SolarCity and Sunrun can't come in and lease you the solar power. You know, these popular leasing programs, basically, where you can get solar panels on your rooftop for no money down. You know, that's kind of been the model that's unlocked solar for hundreds of thousands of households across the country. That business model is actually illegal in Florida.
Let me interrupt you there. How did that become illegal? I mean, you can lease a car there. You can lease an office space. Why is it illegal to lease solar panels in Florida? And how did they rationalize that to voters?
It was a result of a Supreme Court decision. Pratt & Whitney was doing some manufacturing activity down there, and they had some cogeneration that was going on. So they wanted to feed their excess power onto the grid and become sort of a mini utility without being regulated like a utility. And there was a Supreme Court decision that established that was not legal. Most state law is pretty ambiguous, but there's only three or four states where it's patently illegal for third parties to be in the utility market, and Florida is one of those states, and the largest of those states. And so it turns out that, you know, not only can't Solar City get in there, but if you're a Walmart or a Publix, and you own a grocery chain down in the South, if you own a shopping mall complex, you can't, you know, put solar panel on your rooftop and then even sell it to your tenants. So the result of the Supreme Court decision basically has created this status quo where the monopoly grip on utility sales is essentially absolute. And so the only way that you can get solar power in Florida is if you have the financial wherewithal to put it on your roof yourself. And that's very few people have that. So there's fewer than, I think, 9,000 people have solar rooftops in Florida, which is just kind of astonishing. I mean, I live here in Portland, Oregon, and you drive around, you see solar panels everywhere because they're very friendly state policies towards solar. But you drive around Tallahassee, and it's just blinding sunshine, and there's just no solar panels on any of the roofs, and it's just a head scratcher.
And it seems like the umbrella over all of this that kind of casts a shadow on the Sunshine State are these investor-owned utilities, the IOUs. Why don't you explain what they are and how they somehow got a grip on the state like this?
Well, so the investor-owned utilities, there are four major ones. I think there's a fifth small one, and there's some regional utilities. But the basic gist is that they have under Florida's regulated monopoly market, they have the state divided in basically four, and there's four regions and four big companies, and they all have monopoly power within their region. And so Florida Power and Light is the biggest one, but Duke Energy is there too. TECO is another one, Tampa Electric Company, I think it is. And so they are in their regions, they are the monopoly. And so if you're a resident of Florida, you live in one of these regions, and you have to buy your power from these companies. And these companies give huge amounts of money to the political process. They spend a lot on lobbying, and they essentially, even the ex-governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, told me they have a pretty good harness on the situation up there. So they are able to control the state legislature, and the state legislature in turn controls it's the Public Utility Commission. It's called the Public Service Commission there. Which sets the rates and the conditions for selling power in the state. And so by having a lock on the legislature and then on the Public Service Commission, the utilities are sort of in a position of regulating themselves. And they do this all with money that they take from captive ratepayers. So people, in essence, are paying a monopoly, which then lobbies against their own self-interest.
So we haven't followed the money all the way up. Why don't you explain how deep-pocketed interests like the Koch brothers are manipulating the system in Florida for their own gain?
The Koch brothers' influence is felt mostly through a front group called ALEC, with the American Legislative Exchange Council, of which they're a sort of corporate board member and have funded for years and years. And ALEC is kind of a right-wing bill mill. They write legislation that tends to get adopted often wholesale by Republican legislators who are oftentimes taking money from the same interests. And so ALEC is sort of the group that is, in addition to the utility's own trade group, ALEC is sort of providing the intellectual muscle and the legislative firepower behind initiatives to block solar power. So ALEC has sort of, you know, it's this very free market group. So, and they have sort of twisted themselves into knots to try and paint solar power as somehow not free market and monopoly utilities as free market. It doesn't make any sense, but they've come out with documents that that twist and turn and turn and twist until somehow solar power here is the enemy of free markets and democracy and the monopoly utilities are just and advocates for the poorest among us, and none of it has any sort of intellectual it just doesn't hold together, but that's what they're arguing because that's where their financial interests are.
Woman, don't you give me no crocodile tears. I'll never take you back in a million years. Don't let the sun get you crying. Crying in my rondeau. You done dirty, dirty. He sure don't want you no more.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined by Rolling Stone reporter Tim Dickinson. His latest piece is The Koch Brothers' Dirty War on Solar Power. What I don't understand is why a group like the Edison Electric Institute is purely a fossil fuel electric trade group. I mean, there are utilities who have made a significant investment into renewables.
Yeah, so EEI is the trade group of the electric utilities, and they, back in 2013, put out a report sort of talking about the financial peril that the utilities face because of distributed energy like solar power. It's less, these folks are conservative by orientation, and so they know fossil fuels and they know nuclear power, and so that's where they're most comfortable. I think they're gaining some confidence in renewables in part because state legislators have told them to go do it as a part of renewable portfolio standards. But for the utilities, the real battle is which side of the meter is the power being generated on. If they can generate their own solar panels and sell it in the traditional model to customers, well, then they can still profit, and they can profit from building the infrastructure. But when other third parties are the ones who are customers themselves are buying solar panels, or they're paying for leased solar panels, that's infrastructure spending that the utility shareholders don't get a bite of. They don't get their 10% profit on top of whatever the cost of that installation is, and it prevents another installation from being built on the other side of the meter, because all of a sudden you don't need those electrons to be added to the system, and then you lose out on recurring power sales too. So it's a real direct threat. I mean, for years and years it's been power generated at a distance of many miles from population centers, carried over a unified set of transmission lines to people's homes. And so that's the way that utilities know how to make money. And so all of a sudden, if you have people making their own power on their own rooftops, and the utility doesn't get a cut of either the power production, the electrons that they're being generated, and they don't get a cut of the infrastructure spending that put those panels on rooftops, well, that's a real big bite of the apple that they're not getting.
So, Tim, let's turn to the politics of it a little bit more, if we can. One of the things that you point out in your piece is that the Florida legislature, these are part-time lawmakers. They only make $30,000 a year, and they're subject to strict term limits. And both Republicans and Democrats believe that this is actually giving more power to the lobbyists and making a situation like the reality of what's happening right now when it comes to the solar industry in Florida more tenable.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in this weird way, Florida is kind of this bizarro California. So as progressive as California is in promoting green energy and advancing climate change policy, Florida is dominated by Republicans and very much the reverse. And so, Tallahassee is this weird little southern city so far away from, it's like an 8-hour drive from Miami and 4 hours from Tampa. It's really at a great remove from the population centers. And you have all of these, you know, term limited baby face Republican legislators up there in Tallahassee running point on policy that they don't really understand. And so you have like realtors who are in charge of the energy subcommittee, and it's sort of nonsensical. And so there's never any time to, or much incentive really for these folks to get very smart on the actual policy. And the institutional powers, in which, you know, here and there in Tallahassee, tend to be the big donors, among which the utilities are, the gorilla. For me, it was kind of eye-opening to go there, because usually as a reporter, when you start poking around someplace and say, you know, looking for allegations of corruption or abuses of the campaign finance system, you kind of have to get down to the level of a public policy person who's done a study and says, oh, I'm a little concerned about what's happening here. But in Florida, you talk to, you know, former Republican legislators who served on the Public Service Committee, who say this whole system is incredibly corrupt, and the IOUs are the corrupting influence here. And so they have just total ownership over the legislature, and the legislature appoints the PSC commissioners, and the PSC commissioners are beholden to industry, and they make decisions that give the utilities, you know, millions, if not billions, in profits. And so very small, relatively speaking, small investments in the political system reap extraordinary benefits from the policies that emerge from the Public Service Commission.
We often think of term limits as a way to try to stifle corruption, but here it seems like it's allowed it to flourish.
I think that's right, and I think that's often the case with term limits, that you have a rotating cast of folks who are trying to use their very short time in office to advance themselves, and the way that you advance yourself most easily is by doing favors for powerful people. And so I think that happens in Florida to a sort of comical degree.
And do you think it might be magnified by the fact that they're paid so little and it's just a part-time job? If they were paid, let's say, $100,000 a year and it was a full-time job, they, even with term limits, there may be less incentive for these lawmakers to make backroom deals with the utilities.
And ironically, the folks who actually do get six figures are the people on the Public Service Commission. So you've done your time in the legislature for peanuts, and then all of a sudden you get this plum position on the Public Service Commission, earning $100,000 a year, more than that, and your incentive is to keep that job, and you keep that job by keeping the legislature happy, and the legislature is responsive to what's going on with the utilities, and so the whole system is just sort of set up for the utilities to get what they want, and they do repeatedly. I mean, there's a, you know, as sort of backwards as Florida is on solar power. You know, and the utilities are always talking about how their main interest is consumer protection, but it works out in Florida that the law in Florida is that the utilities will get paid for work on nuclear plants, regardless of whether they actually ever end up being finished, or whether, if they're working on repairs, whether the plant that's being repaired ever produces another megawatt or kilowatt of electricity. And so in South Florida, in the Tampa region, customers there are paying something like $4 billion for a pair of nuclear plants that are either broken or will never get finished. And that money is just sunk cost that folks are paying to the power companies for bad investments that they made. So it's really a double-edged sword, where the utilities get paid for for not producing energy at the same time that they block competition. And so, I mean, I want to get to the ballot initiative that the people in Florida were trying to advance to sort of break open the utilities' grip on electric power.
Explain this. I think we've had a few of these in California, where a group just kind of throws up their hands and kind of surrenders to the deep moneyed interests. This is pretty depressing.
Right. Well, in many states there are ballot initiatives processes, and the folks in, you know, they're good legislators in Florida who are trying to do the right thing and trying to make the state friendlier for solar power. And they've just gotten nowhere in the Republican controlled legislature. And so there was a really pretty interesting coalition of Tea Party activists and Sierra Club members and business interests, the retail federations and the entertainment restaurant federations in Florida, all got together and tried to put an initiative on the ballot that essentially would have legalized third-party sales, so essentially made it possible for Sunrun and SolarCity to come in and made it possible for Walmart to put solar panels on their rooftop up to a certain megawatt configuration and then sell the power to their tenants or to neighbors. And so this was a major threat to monopoly profits in Florida. And the utilities rather quickly figured out that this was a very popular idea, and so they, instead of trying to fight the ballot proposition directly, just sort of a no on this solar choice campaign, they ended up putting forward their own disinformation ballot initiative. And so it was called the Smart Solar Campaign, which sounded like it was opening up the state to solar power, but in fact did nothing of the sort. And in fact reserved for the utilities the right to hit rooftop solar customers with high fees just for maintaining their connection to the electrical grid. But it became, instead of a popular citizen-run initiative, all of a sudden you had this very confusing situation of two ballot initiatives that even for a reporter like me, I get confused in trying to describe which is the smart solar, which is the solar choice, and the smart solar, the utility-funded measure, and it was funded very nakedly by millions of dollars from the utilities themselves. So it's the Smart Solar Initiative, but they, in their sort of formal ballot language title, which you would see if you're a petition signer, they put the word solar choice in their formal ballot title, which is the marketing language of the competing initiative. And so you had, you know, this basically this sort of arms race also for signature gatherers out on the streets, and the utilities were paying much more to the signature gatherers than the sort of activist supported solar choice amendment could afford. And eventually they just sort of blew them out of the water. The pro solar people couldn't essentially keep up with the fundraising demands that were created by having to beat out a competing initiative.
So explain what they ended up doing.
Well, so they've something like 400,000 signatures, although some of them are tied up in a dispute with one of the signature gathering firms. But those signatures will be good for, I think, 2 years. And so they've essentially, instead of going for the 2016 ballot, are now aiming for the 2018 ballot, which is less of a certain proposition because the presidential year voting electorate tends to be much more progressive and younger and sort of hipper to the idea of competing solar, you know, allowing solar competition in the state. But so they are regrouping and aiming for the 2016 ballot, but the industry funded solar measure remains an active proposition and could sort of help entrench the power of the utilities going forward, regardless of what happens. So it was just sort of a really interesting example and kind of complex, but of just the power of the industry to put usually on a ballot initiative like this, there'd be more incentive to hide behind front groups. But for the most part, the utilities were just out in front spending, you know, I think four of the $6 million that the Smart Solar Initiative raised. And the rest of the money was coming from Koch-funded front groups like 60 Plus. And there's some other business alliances and the Koch-funded a grassroots group, Americans for Prosperity. Their chapter there in Florida was active in turning out activists to try and defeat the measure. So it's just sort of this naked confluence of utility money and Koch money working against a ballot initiative that would have brought a free market competition to the state of Florida, which is ironic given that most of these groups tend to have a free market orientation, but here they were fighting against utility deregulation and fighting for monopoly utilities. Going out and get me some sun.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Rolling Stone reporter Tim Dickinson. So, Tim, in your piece, you quote a pretty unlikely character in Florida's solar battle, this Debbie Dooley. Who is Debbie Dooley? Is she a legislator or something?
No, she's one of the original founding members of the Tea Party, and it's just a real character, this grandmother from Georgia with this sort of delicious drawl who campaigns for solar power as a matter of energy freedom. And I think that sort of people who are on the coast or people who think of clean energy as a green proposition, I think are missing an important part of what's interesting about solar power is that it has strong appeal among folks who think that the utility company is every bit the man as the government is, and really sees solar panels kind of the way people see guns, as sort of a token of independence and I can make my own way, thank you. And so there's a lot of people on from the right wing of the political spectrum who are fighting for solar power as a matter of free market economics and energy freedom. And so Debbie Dooley is the sort of avatar of that political movement. And she runs a nonprofit that advocates for this stuff and has been very effective. She helped open up Georgia's closed utility market to solar power recently.
She uses the messaging right out of the conservative playbook, but for clean energy, which makes it even more effective in a purple state like Florida.
Right, and I, as a reporter, it was a little disappointing to see this, because it really is an unusual political coalition. So it was a little disappointing to see it get stomped so thoroughly by the utility initiative. But because I think it would have been an interesting thing to watch in an election year. You know, here's this very popular solar initiative competing on the stage in Florida, which is obviously an important swing state, and an issue that cuts across sort of traditional partisan lines. And I think you're going to see this more moving forward. I mean, you have solar advocates now in places like Utah and Nebraska who are sort of, you're going to pry my solar panels from my cold, dead hands. And I think we're seeing some of this in Nevada and Arizona and these other states where people are really up in arms about what's happened to the solar industry in their states. And so going forward, I think solar is one of these sort of rare issues that it isn't going to hew to our normally divisive American politics, and there's no real reason for it to, because it is a matter of, people can become energy entrepreneurs by putting some panels on the roof and selling to their neighbors. It's sort of as American as apple pie once you get past the powerful vested interests who are want to keep America hooked on fossil fuels.
He's a reporter for Rolling Stone, Tim Dickinson. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by James Brown, Dr. John, and Little Village. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.